Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, and our speaker is Mike Kay from Bel Air, Maryland.
I like the clock. Hi, group. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. What a relief to say that and to know that. You know, when I got here, I just thought I was nuts. I am nuts. It's good to be here. I want to thank David for asking me to come up. It's really an honor and a privilege. Anyone they asked me to do anything in Alcoholics Anonymous, because at the end of my drinking career, no one was asking me to do anything, except for maybe stay away, see you later. It wasn't real pretty. My home group is Bel Air Friday night. We meet at 7:30. My anniversary date is June 16th, 1997, just to help you guys connect the dots as I'm going along. I have a sponsor. I am a sponsor. I brought some of my guys up with me. I like to torture them every once in a while. So I know they've heard my story. Some of them can tell my story. But, you know, it's my story. It's the only one I have. And I don't get into a big drunkalog because I don't remember a lot of it. You know, and what I do remember, my family told me. You know, but and that's kind of what I put out there. But I'll start back when I was a kid, and I believe I was born thirsty. Because when the doctor cracked me on the butt in July 28, 1953, I didn't go, wow, I want AA, and I knew I was on my way. You know, I tell you, it was tough being me. Really. I mean, self-absorbed and, you know, and just full of fear and insecurities. And I don't believe any of this makes me an alcoholic, you know, because I believe there were a lot of kids who felt the same way I felt. And, you know, I was either thinking about me or I was wondering what you were thinking about me. It was tough. And, you know, and I always had a tough time in school. My parents had to drag me into the first grade, literally. You know, I thought it was punishment. You know, people were punishing me. You know, because they were telling me what to do, and I didn't want to do it. And if you would ask me in the first grade what I wanted to be when I grew up, I would have told you left alone. And I got my wish, because people were running. I had them just where I wanted them when I got here. But those people are back in my life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people in the 12 steps and a God of my understanding. And it's but for the grace of God that I'm standing here, because I really, like a lot of you, don't belong here. You know, and when I get ungrateful, my sponsor tells me to ride by the cemetery and apologize for being a no-show. Because I really have a wonderful life today because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I would take you back to that first drink, that spiritual awakening that we all have at an early age. I had mine at 12, and I couldn't wait. Like I said, I was real thirsty. Because I remember bartending for, I used to watch my family drink around the holidays, and I used to bartend for them, go and crack the beer and take a little sip. You know. And I'd get that little buzz. But I remember the first time, I believe this is what makes me the alcoholic. I remember getting that guy in the neighborhood to buy that six-pack for me and a buddy of mine. And they were Colt 45 malt liquor, 16-ounce cans. They were almost as tall as I was. And I remember into that second can and into that third can, and we were almost finished. And I looked my buddy in the eye, and I said to him, "Whew, I wonder what more would be like." And that's why I'm standing here. I chased more for 30 years. Anything that would take Michael out of Michael. Anything. You know, I don't get into a whole lot of the other substances. You know, people like to say they've done other substances, but I believe the substance has done me. Got me in here a whole lot quicker. A whole lot quicker. I said I started drinking when I was 12 or 13, and I said, "Oh, what a relief!" You know, I was this fat, chubby little kid. I had this wiry hair, chipped tooth. And all of a sudden, I took that first drink. I was 30 pounds lighter, you know. I just felt so good about myself. I said, man, this is it. I always want to feel this way. And I always wanted to feel that way. No matter what I did, I always wanted to feel that way. You know, but as the progression went on, you know, like most kids, you know, I drank weekends and I can see the progression. You know, a six pack, eight, 12, you know, and then I couldn't wait to get to the bar. You know. Couldn't wait. And I used to pride myself in being able to sit in a bar all day from 12 o'clock in the afternoon and closing it. I used to thought that was like a badge of honor. Man, I could drink. All the guys in my neighborhood, we got these T-shirts one summer, and it had LDR on the front, and on the back it had long distance runners. And we were talking about our drinking. You know, we were proud of that. You know, and I saw nothing wrong with that. I really didn't. I mean, I don't believe I was an instant alcoholic. I believe I drank alcoholically. You know, I drank to excess. I drank to oblivion. But it took a little while before I had any consequences in my life, and the wheels started coming off the cart. And of course, like any alcoholic, I didn't see the wheels coming off the cart. There's a gentleman I hear share, his name's Tom Flynn, and he calls them direct hits. And I married my childhood sweetheart at the age of 22, and she was a lovely young lady, come from a nice Catholic family, neighborhood gal, one or two, or her brother went away to be a priest. Matter of fact, her brother married us. And I remember when I first started dating her, I used to say to her, you know, Karen, I don't think your parents like me. Of course, I didn't see it. They saw it. They saw what kind of character I was. And I was a character. And I just didn't know it. And I took his girl places. I now know why her mother and father never liked me. But her brother married us. I was 22 years old. She was 21. And it lasted 3 years. I went with her for 7, and it lasted 3 years. And I look back in retrospect and say, why in the heck did she even marry me? Because I was very abusive. You know, physically, emotionally, spiritually. And she said, I do. And you know, and I believe I got married just like a lot of people got married in my day. I got married because everyone else was getting married. I don't know if anyone ever did that, but it was fashionable, like smoking. I didn't know how to be a husband. I was clueless. I was clueless about life. I worked for my family business. If it wasn't for my father having a job waiting for me when I got out of high school, I don't know what I would have done. You know, I didn't have any like aspirations or goals or dreams. Like I said, I just didn't really want to be anything. I could care less. Once I started to party, you know, that's what I wanted to do. I loved everything about party. My buddies used to come by the house when I was in high school. My father used to kid me all the time because I was a poor student and I could care less. And he said to me one day, they have books where you go to school, Mike? I never brought a book home. I said, yeah, why you ask that question? I thought it was a trick question. And he used to tell my buddies I was going to be an astronaut. They said, really, Mr. Kirby? He said, yeah, because he takes up space in school. See, and I was kind of the brunt of all my family's joke. My father knew where I was headed before I knew where I was headed. You know, the handwriting was on the wall. You know, when I was 14, I told him, I backed him up. I said, you'll never tell me what to do again. That's it. And he didn't even try after that. didn't even try. He just let me go. Let me go. He knew he couldn't stop me. I was a runaway train. And I love being my own man. I couldn't wait to be my own man. And here I am, 57 years old, and I'm still working on that. God gave me a second chance to grow up again. Isn't that beautiful? Really beautiful. That's why I love AA. I'm reborn. Getting a second shot at life. And if I got what I deserved, I wouldn't be standing here. Believe it. So anyway, that girl left me after 3 years of marriage, after some more torture that I put her through. And there was a direct hit that I didn't see, you know, but as I call it, another wheel off the cart. And it took me a while to get over that because I was devastated by that, you know, because I said, oh, no one ever loved me again. And then I discovered more booze and more drugs. I found my love. And I got heavier into that. And like I said, I worked for the family business. And this is when my life started to get a little unmanageable. I was about 25, 26. I started missing work. Never did. I was a good employee at that point. I really was. Even though I partied, I was always there, available for my family and all. And then when she left me, I said, that's it. I started missing work every other day. I couldn't get out of bed. I mean, that's how I drank. I just could not get out of bed. And I would leave every night, and I'd tell my mother and father, because I moved back in with them after we split up. Mommy and Daddy took me back home. And I would say to him, every night I went out, I used to say to him, I'll be home early tonight. I'm only going out for a few. I must have said that hundreds of times. I never hit that mark. And I remember looking up at the clock and say, oh, I'll stay till 10. And then when 10 came, I said, oh, I'll stay till 11. Oh, I'll just stay till 12. And then, of course, that one sound I hate, last call. I hated that because I was never done. I mean, I was, but I didn't think I was ever done. Then I would go home and burn food and burn furniture, and my father would say, Jesus, Mary, he bought two recliners. He said, I'm not buying any more, man. He said, you put big holes in them. I'd come home and light a cigarette and fall asleep. It's amazing I didn't burn the house down. You know, and my father was another one I kind of kept myself in a little check for. And then somewhere in the mid-80s, I lost him of cancer. And a lot of times this is hard for me to share this because, we are unavailable. You know, and I love my father no matter what. And my father loved me, and I knew that. And I was unavailable for the man. I had lost that job with the family because they wouldn't give me another week's vacation. I was already up to 3 months a year. I tried to get one more week. So this is alcoholic thinking. I said to them, hey, I want another week's vacation. They said, Mike, you got to be kidding me. I said, no. And they said, no. And guess what? You know, here's the alcoholic plan. I quit. I worked for my family for 12 years. They put up with all my stuff. I know my brother, older brother, wanted to kill me half the time, but he depended on me. So about a month later, I walked into my local watering hole. I used to call it my launching pad because I remember the neighbors used to see me going down the street. I used to look good going out. Like real nice going down to the bar. Hey, where are you going, Mike? I used to tell them I was on a mission. I didn't really know. And I was on a mission. I'm on a mission to destroy me and anyone else that wants to come with me. Come on. It's amazing. And I think about the way I used to drink. I just can't believe it. I can't believe it. And like I said, I walked into that bar one day and the owner called me over and said, come here, Michael. I said, yes, sir. What are we going to do for you? He said, I hear you're out of work. I said, yes, that's true. He said, how would you like to work here? I said, doing what? He said, bartending. Oh. You know, I could hear the angels singing. I looked up, the sky separated. I said, you got to be kidding me. And that launched a 6-year career of daily drinking and a whole lot of free drinking. I loved it. Every bar owner that ever hired me, and I worked in a lot of bars because I had to quit before they fired me. That's the kind of guy I was. I was missing the register a lot. I don't know if any bartender's ever done that, but I used to miss the register. Because while I was in that, when I started that bartending career, I was introduced to this stuff, this powder substance. I referred to it as soup and sandwich today. It's beautiful. My drinking started to do a little, you know, my tolerance level started to do a little bit of a flip. And I couldn't drink like I used to. And then somebody turned me on to this substance one night, and I went, I said, oh, man, this is good stuff. I can drink all night. It was like a match made in heaven. I said, this is beautiful. So needless to say, a couple months later, I'm chasing all over Baltimore City for this thing. I was out of control. And I got into, then I started ripping and running and stealing from bar owners. Like I said, I worked in about 14, 15 different bars and quit before they fired me. And that lasted for about 6 years. And then finally I was unemployed, unemployable. Terrible. I had a terrible habit. Now I'm unemployed and unemployable. What do you do? You know, we're resilient. You know, we'll come up a way. So, you know, and being the entrepreneur I am, I decided to get into some pharmaceutical sales. And I thought that was a good idea. And it's probably the reason why I'm standing here having this talk with you all. Because I started selling this stuff to support my habit, and I did it for a few years, and somewhere in there I sold to an undercover state trooper 5 times. I thought he'd like my stuff. He said he did. I didn't know he was a trooper at the time, but he looked like one of us. He had long hair. So I was facing 50 years when it was all said and done. But they let me run for a while, and in the interim, I'm running around Baltimore City. I'm originally from Baltimore City, born and raised. I'm 1 of 6, Irish, Italian, Catholic. Sister Mary Charles Bronson in school, you know. I used to get beat up quite regularly, either from them or mom and dad. It didn't matter. Somebody used to. That's why I drank. So really, it got kind of bad, and I started putting this stuff in me any way I could get it in me, and it was horrible. Friends of mine used to run into me on the street, and usually at night. You know, when the cockroaches come out, and if you were looking for lower companionship in the late 80s, you were looking for me, because I was it. This would have been like 1988, 1989, and like I said, it started getting real ugly, and I became my best customer, and I was living for that stuff. And I was also dying for it because I wanted to die. I asked God every day to take me. I said, will you please take me? I wasn't real specific. He took me to the state system instead for 4 years. Thank you. I appreciate that. So 1989, like I said, it was getting bad. I'm living home with my mother and my father because my father had passed from cancer. And like I said, I was unavailable there. And I still don't like to talk about that too much because it upsets me. And I had two younger brothers living with me, and we were all off the hook. And my mother calls my older brother and older sister and said, hey, I don't know what to do with these guys. They're just, I don't know what to do with them. I can't even sleep in my own bedroom. My mother had to sleep downstairs on a couch with her pocketbook under her head. Not that we were going to take any of it. But they told her to sell the house and put us on the street. And this is all, these are all things that are happening to me that I don't see that's moving me to Alcoholics Anonymous. And my mother put us on the street in June of 1989. Sold the house, said goodbye, here's enough money, you can't kill yourself with this, she said. My mother was something else. She really was. I still have her today. She'll be 85 in December. Little Italian woman, never shuts up. I love her. She repeats herself over and over again. She's driving me crazy. She wants me to take her to Maryland has gambling now. She wants me to take her and put her in front of the slot machine. I said, all right, Ma, hold on. I'll get you there. But that's part of the amends. I do that for her. I take her all over the place. I bring her up here. I bring her to Delaware. I take her wherever she wants to go. I love her because of what she did with me, for me. She hung in there, big time, hung in there. I mean, you know that look we get when we come through the door? Whew. Man, I come through the door one day after a five-day run. Could you imagine what I look like? It wasn't pretty. And she looked at me and said, Michael, she said, you're dying. What am I going to do with you? She said, I don't have insurance on you. I don't, how am I going to bury you? So my mother's having this conversation with me as I'm eating. Here's what she said to me. She said, this is an old saying. A lot of people never heard it. She said, I'll just shove a bone up your rectum and let the dogs drag you away. My mother said to me. That's where I took her. She knew what to do. Because my whole family was talking about burying me. And then my two younger brothers. They were as bad as I was. Like I said, I don't know how my mother did it. And then 3 months later, I'm running the streets of Baltimore, in and out of hotel rooms, and just trying to make it go. And like I said, I'm asking God to take me. I'm praying. I don't even want to live anymore. But I'm too chicken, like a lot of us are, to, you know, I'm not going to blow my brains out. I couldn't afford a gun. I probably wouldn't even know how to pull the trigger, but I wouldn't have done that anyway. So it's Labor Day weekend, 1989. I'm in this hotel all weekend. And I'm up to no good. And Labor Day Monday, 12 o'clock in the afternoon, God sent the rescue squad. Baltimore City, Baltimore County Police Department. First they knocked. It was nice of them. We didn't let them in, but then they kicked the door in. And they said, cuff him. We got a warrant for his arrest. And they took me out of there. And here I am. Thank God. You know, I did 4 years in the state system, and I still couldn't connect the dots that there was something wrong with me, you know, that I had, that I was an alcoholic and an addict. You know, I see people in 28-day treatment centers, and I go do meetings there, and I say to them, listen, if you think 28 days is enough, let me tell you, I had 4 years to think about it, and I couldn't come up with the right answer. As soon as I hit the street, I was off to the races again, after 4 years of prison. I remember being home 2 months, and my PO came to my house one morning, and I said to her, could you send me back to jail? She looked at me like I was crazy. And I was. She said, what's the matter, Michael? I said, I can't function out here. I didn't know how to function. Alcohol and drugs took everything from me. If you just saw me walking the streets when I got out of prison, you would have thought I was a sidewalk inspector. Because I could not look people in the eye. I walked around with my head down. I see people today doing that, and I know exactly what they're about. They're walking down a road or something, and I see them with their heads down. I've been there. Whew, what a horrible place to be. Loser. Big time. So I'm home about 2 years. can't keep jobs, you know, and now I'm working for paychecks. Anybody ever done that? Get a paycheck, goodbye, you know. Things are getting bad again. Like I said, I can't keep a job. I'm unemployed. I'm unemployable. And I get a phone call from a young lady. Matter of fact, she was my brother Gary's girlfriend. And she called me. She said to me, Mike, what are you doing? What am I doing? Nothing. She said, listen, I have to ride downtown Baltimore then. I said, I got to go in. She said, I just got a settlement from an insurance company. She said, I'm going to pick up the check. Would you like to go with me? And I said, are you here yet? And I remember watching her go into the bank. And I'm sitting in the car, and I'm watching her come out of the bank. And when she come out of the bank, I went like this, touchdown. Yeah, I love this time of year talking about touchdown. Go Phillies. And we went on a 2-week run with that money. 2-week run. And the run was almost over. The money was almost gone. And I'm sitting in a hotel room one night with her and another friend of mine. I don't know what happened to my brother Gary. We lost him in a shuffle. You know how we do. They did it to me. I woke up one morning, they were gone. So I'm sitting in the bed one night, we're partying, and I get this thought. I said, you know, Mike, I don't know, you hear a moment of clarity? I don't know what the heck you want to call it. God, I don't know. You need to get help. Never. Never wanted help, never asked for help. 2 days later, they left me in that hotel room, and I walked home. I walked to my aunt's house, and I had a guy pick me up, drop me off there. Matter of fact, I was hitchhiking. And I remember going to my aunt's house and said to her, yeah, guess what, Aunt Clara? I said, I'm finished. I'm going to get help. She said, sure you are. My family heard me enough. And I said the same thing to my mother when I got home. I said, Mom, I'm going to get help. She said, sure you are. You know, and I think, I don't tell this a lot, but my younger brother was an AA. He's no longer in AA, but he's still sober. It's his choice. But he used to say to me all the time when I was, you know, when I first got out, he used to plant these seeds. You know, Mike, you don't have to live that way anymore. And I don't know what the hell he was talking about. You know, it doesn't have to be this way anymore. And he was planting seeds for me. So after that run, I was in a drug and alcohol group, part of the provisions of my parole and probation. I had to do it for 5 years, and I had this counselor, and I called her. I said, listen, I need to get help. I said, I want to get help. She said, Michael, I don't know where we're going to put you. She said, you're not working. She said, let's see if we can get you into a state-funded facility. And she did. She got me into a state-funded facility in Carroll County in Maryland. And I stayed there 28 days. And I would like to tell you that I was clueless. You know, I mean, I don't know. The wires were singed. I don't know. I didn't know what these people were talking about. I really didn't. And there was people sitting in those groups, and they were like talking about how they were feeling. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. How am I feeling? They asked me how I was feeling. I said, wait, how do you mean how am I feeling? No one ever asked me that question. How are you feeling? I didn't know. I didn't know. And I stayed there for 28 days. And in that 28 days, I heard people talking about halfway houses and extended treatment and stuff like that. And I knew I couldn't go back home. I knew my track record. So I went to my counselor and I said, is there any way you could get me into a halfway house? And she said to me, Mike, I doubt it. She said, they're usually for like chronic relapsers. And I said, what does that mean? I have to leave here and come back a couple times? Oh. I mean, I could do that, if that's what you want. Matter of fact, my brother's waiting for me to come home. He said to me, you'll be back. So she went to bat for me and got me an interview for a halfway house. And I met you people in there that used to bring meetings in. I liked the meetings, and I met a gentleman in there who was real spiritual, always talked about God, and I asked him to sponsor me temporarily. And here's a kid who went to Catholic school, and I asked this guy, I said, I had to humble myself. I said, could you do me a favor? I said, what do you pray for? I said, I know I'm supposed to pray. What do I pray for? He said, Mike, what do you need? I said, I need a halfway house. He said, why don't you pray for a halfway house? I remember I was in a room with six other guys, and I used to hurry up and run upstairs before they got there. I don't know if I see me on my knees. That's not happening. I went upstairs. I said, God, please, I want to get out and get me halfway. You know, 3 days later, she comes to me and said, Mike, I got you an interview for a halfway house. I said, thank you. It works. And I remember that interview like it was yesterday. The guy kept on asking me the same question over and over again. I wanted to hit him. He said, Mike, by the way, what do you want out of this halfway house? I said, structure. I knew what to tell him because I knew what I needed, structure. I was a model inmate. I functioned well in jail. If you give me structure, I'm wonderful. He said to me again, Mike, what do you want out of this house? I said, structure. And then he asked me one more time, and then I was screaming it over. He said to me, I'm glad. He said, I keep asking you that. He said, because we're going to shove structure down your throat. And they did. About 38 rules and regulations, know this, know that. I went there anyway. Because I knew I needed to be there. And I was accepted there. And I was there a few months, and they asked me to be cook there. I became a staff member there. And I had a sponsor. They made me get a sponsor. They made me get a home group. You know what they make you. Because they threatened to throw me out of the house because I wasn't doing it quick enough, you know. And I couldn't figure out why I needed to do any of this. I really couldn't, you know. And once I became a staff member, you know, I had a sponsor for a little bit. You know, I had it looking good for about a year, you know. I had the sponsor. I wasn't doing any steps. You know, none of this was really important. Steps, I didn't need steps. What I need steps were, I knew what the problem was now. You know, don't drink and don't drug, and I'm going to live happily ever after. I had it all figured out. I didn't make it quite 2 years. And I was locked down in a hotel room. 10 days shy of my second anniversary. No steps, no sponsor, no God. Running on self-propulsion. Just the way I came in here. Extreme example, it says, of self-will run riot. You got it. Because no one was telling me what to do. I tell my guys today, you know what you can tell an alcoholic? Nothing. You couldn't tell me anything. And I did this for about 3 years. I tried dating. I thought she was it. I said, if I have her, and I have the car and the job, you know, I had it all figured out. You know, you talk about the actor in the big book. Well, you're looking at him. And I know a lot of you are the same way. I got into this relationship with this gal. This poor gal. Oh. She was recently separated. And I was probably sober 2 weeks when we met, and she had about a month. Love. I know you've been there. Well, I found out what love is. And, you know, love is unselfish. So I believe it to be lust. And that's what it was. So her and I met, and a month later I was moving in her house. You know how we go. Let's set up camp. She had two little kids. She had a little girl, it was two, and she had a little boy that was four, and me. The kids used to run down the steps when I would come home from work. I used to say, what's wrong with them? She said, they're afraid of you. I said, you're kidding. And she was afraid of me. I had that whole crew saluting me when I came home. I tell you, this is a funny story. I had them. I was living there. I moved in about August, September. And here was December. And we had the family over for a Christmas brunch, my family and her family. So we had a little table set up for the little ones. And her family came in, my family came in, and the kids came. It was time to eat, and the kids come sat over by the table. And her father looked at these kids, like, because they were unruly until I got there. Father looked at them and said, "Whose kids are they?" And I went like this. I got it. This girl was throwing glass ashtrays at me 6 months into this relationship. Sober. She wanted to put my lights out. And I don't blame her. See, because after about a few months, you know, we figured that people in Alcoholics Anonymous were talking about us because we shouldn't be dating or living together. So we just quit AA. I said to her, "Let's quit." I said, "We'll read the 24-hour every morning or little readings, and we'll pray, and we'll be all right." She said, "Okay." Well, that relationship lasted a year. And this is where I believe it, what happened. And what happened was we were on vacation for a week with her family. See, her father used to manage our lives. I needed someone managing my life. He managed my life for about a year. He used to write his checks to live on every month. That was a hard relationship to get out of. But because the last 6 months of it, I wasn't even working. But it was nice. So anyway, we were on vacation with her family for about a week, and it was miserable. We fought the whole week. It was horrible. Her father and mother would hear her screaming and hollering. And we were driving home, and I'm having this anxiety, and, oh, man, what am I doing? I know I don't belong in this. How do I get out of this? I was clueless, man. I'm running, like I said, I'm running on self-propulsion. I'm still trying to figure it out and do it and call my own shots. I got it. We unloaded the car. I went down her basement. It was nice and dark, and I sat down on her couch, and I thought I was having a nervous breakdown. And I think I was. I started to shake, and I started to tremble. I said, "Oh, my God, what's happening?" And his voice inside of me said, "Hey, Mike, you belong in AA, and here I am." I left that relationship. I come up out of that basement. I say goodbye. I'm packing my stuff. I got my stuff packed. I left an hour later. I went into my brother's. I asked him if I could move in with him. He said, "Come on in." And I knew exactly what I needed to do. That voice inside of me said to me, "Son, I think you need to open up the big book." And I opened it up to that third step prayer. And I started reading that on a daily basis. Because I needed to be relieved from the bondage itself. And I knew that. And I needed my difficulties taken away. Because I was a mess. A mess. You know the acronym they use for nuts, not using the steps? There you go. I was nuts. And I knew, you know what, it's funny, I knew exactly what I needed to do. The opposite of what I did the first time around. I had to ask people for help. I had to ask someone to sponsor me, and that was hard. You know how hard that is. It's like asking someone to marry you. You know. "Will you sponsor me?" And I asked a guy to sponsor me. Guess what? He's still with me today. Isn't that beautiful? He's still my sponsor. He's got 20-something years sober. He's a wonderful, loving man. And he walked me through these 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And they say, "It's some of these we balked." I tell you what. You know, I always share this. There wasn't at that, "Oh, what an order." An alcoholic never said that. If you know what I mean. Because I didn't say, "Oh, what an order." I said, "You got to be kidding me with all this." You know, like a little kid went, why do I have to do this? Why? My sponsor said, "Do you want to live? That's why. You want to change the way you feel about yourself? That's why." And I kept hearing this inside job, but, you know, we're so stuck on the surface when we get here, we don't know what an inside job is. Then he started walking me through the steps. I joined a big book study group. I knew exactly what I needed to do. I was in a meeting one night, and a girl said, "I'm having a big book study group." I stuck my hand up. I said, "Can I join?" I don't know where that came from. I'm like, "Jesus, where the big book study? What's wrong with you? Are you really meaning this?" And I was. I was. You know what? I move at the speed of pain. I don't know about anyone in here, but I found that out. And believe me, I was moving. Of course, you know, we were talking about the book, and we were going in, and I was just sitting there, and a lot of people had a lot of time there. They were in this study, and I didn't have really any time, and like I said, I was clueless. But I was there, physically there, and I understood step one. I couldn't drink, you know. I couldn't drug. And I knew unmanageability, and my sponsor explained unmanageability to me real quick. He said, "Mike, listen, when you're sitting in a cafeteria setting, and you have to wait for them to do a spoon count before you can leave, your life might be unmanageable." I said, I got that. That put unmanageability in. And I actually believe the first three steps happened for me in that girl's basement. I believe I came to believe I belonged in Alcoholics Anonymous when I was down there. And I started, you know, and I started reaching out to this guy that I didn't think would have anything to do with me. I really didn't. And then finally, my sponsor got me on his fourth step at somebody's we bought. It took me 2 weeks. He said to me after we did the third step prayer, he said, "I want you to go home." He said, "You start this fourth step immediately." I said, "Oh, come on, you got to be kidding me. There can't be any urgency here to do this." So I waited 2 weeks. And I'm sitting in my little apartment watching TV. And all of a sudden, this obsession hit me. I want to go drink. I want to go to the bar. And I put my clothes on. I run out, call my sponsor. I went to a meeting. And I'm sitting there, and somebody says, "Anybody have anything to share?" I raise my hand. I said, "I want to drink." And you know how you people are. You all grab me after the meeting. "What's wrong, Mike?" And you know what the question is, don't you? "What step are you on?" I said, "I'm supposed to be on the fourth step." And they said, "Well, what's the problem?" I said, "I haven't started yet." And this little woman, she couldn't have been but this tall, about as tall as this podium, she calls me over. She said, "Come here, boy, little southern gal." She said, "I'm going to tell you right now, if you want to stay sober, you will go home tonight and start this fourth step. And I'm going to tell you how to start it, what to put on. Do you have everything?" I said, "Yes, I have everything." Well, of course, you know, you buy the pencils one day and the paper the next week. You know, you no hurry. And you know what? I went home that night and started that fourth step. And that's why I'm standing here. The leveling of pride, what it talks about in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to tell another human being exactly what I was all about. And I didn't know what a freaking character defect was. Believe me, we didn't talk about that in a bar as I ordered a beer. And I'm like, "What character defect are you working on today?" You guys were speaking a language when I got here that was like, it was weird. It really was. Now I understand it's called the language of the heart. And I wasn't in touch with my heart when I wasn't. But when I came in touch with my heart, I started to hear it. And I did that fourth step, and I did this fifth step with a gentleman, with that man. He said, "Are you ready?" I said, "Yeah, I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm ready." I didn't want to do this. I didn't, but I knew my life depended on it. You know, I believe if you don't think that this is, you know, for me, if I didn't think this was life or death, I probably wouldn't have done it. And I realized it was life or death for me. So we went to a little park. And I had my little papers and everything written down. And he said, come on, start telling me about it. And I started telling him about it. You know, who I was mad at, you know, my father, my mother, you know, everybody. I was the victim. You know, just like a lot of people. You know, if only they would have done this, or if they'd have left it, they did this, you know. My brother was never there. He was never, my sister was never an older sister. You know, my sponsor told me, he said, recovery starts when the blaming stops. And he made it real clear what my character defects were when we got finished. You know what he said to me? Because he asked me what I thought they were. He said, here, let me clear it up for you. All of them. Is what he said to me. I said, thanks. You know, there were some things that I didn't write down on that paper. I don't know if anybody ever tried that. Anybody ever tried that with your sponsor? Like not writing it down and thinking that you can get away with it. Well, there was a couple things that I did, and I said, nah, you know what? I wouldn't even tell. I mean, I saw a priest when I was about a 4 or 5 months sober, and I talked to him, and I wouldn't even tell him these things. And so my sponsor said, are you finished? I said, yes, I'm finished. Sure, I'm finished. Yeah. Let's go. Let's get the hell out of here. He said, I don't think you're finished. I said, what do you mean? He said, Mike, I'm going to tell you right now, you're as sick as your secrets. And if you don't let go of any all this crap that you're holding on to, he said, I know you've got some things you're holding on to that you don't want to tell me. He goes, I know how you lived. Now tell me about it. And I looked down at the ground, and I told him these things that I did. And when I looked up, I thought he was going to be gone, but he was still sitting there. And he said, you know, you're not that bad. And we talked about the sixth step a little bit, and the character defects, and we did the, as a matter of fact, we did the seventh step prayer there that night together. And then he told me to go home, what it says in the book, go home and reflect for about an hour. And I did that. And as I was reflecting, I said, you know what, now I got to kill him because I told him. Here we go again. What freedom. You know, I didn't understand what was going to happen, but I'm telling you, it happened. And the next day, I got up and I walked into a meeting of Alcoholics, and I was like, phew. I felt like I was finally home. Like I belonged somewhere. You know, I never felt like I belonged anywhere. You know, I hear people share this like they were dropped on this planet, and I felt like that I was dropped here. You know, I lived in Maryland, and they gave me the map to Pennsylvania, you know, and that's my whole life. I was always running into myself or running into people. That's what the big book says. You know, any life in front of self-propulsion, I'm always running into somebody. And then we talked about this amends step, that, you know, with my... He said, you got your list? I said, yeah. I said, it's on my four step. Another trick question, I thought. So mainly with me was my family, my mom, my father. I went to the cemetery. You know, what do you say to your mother? I just said, Ma, you know, I know I wasn't this. You know, what do I need to do? I know I could have been a better son. I could have been, you know, my sponsor said, don't say you're sorry. They already knew I was sorry, the whole crew. She said to me, Michael, you're not that guy anymore. She said, you want to do something for me? Keep doing what you're doing. That's all I ask of you. And like I said, I wrote my father a letter because my sponsor knew that was bothering me. And I wrote my dad a letter. Whew. That was one-sided letter when I got done, I can tell you that. That was hard. Hard to write that to that man. Hard to write that. And I made my amends with my brother and my sister and my ex. You know how hard that was? Because I couldn't get out of looking at her part. My sponsor said to me, "You better apologize for your part." It only took me 8 years. I couldn't find her, all right? That's what he said to me. My sponsor said, "I'm tired of hearing it. Go find her." I found her in 2 weeks. And it's funny, I made that phone call to her because she was living on the other side of town. I couldn't drive. I've seen her since. And I started this, but like I did with my mother. I said, "You know, Karen, I'm sorry I was never a husband or a, you know." She said, "Mike, I know what this is all about." She said, "That AA and that." I said, "Yeah, you know." She said, "My husband has 14 years sober." She said, "I know all about what you're doing." And there's another one who loved me unconditionally. I drove that poor girl nuts. She said, "Michael, keep it up. Keep up the good work." She said, "I've been hearing a lot of good things about you." I said, "Thanks." You know what she said to me after I finally saw her? About New Year's Eve it was, as a matter of fact, this year, last year. She told me I wasn't that bad. Talk about delusional. She was in... She said, "Dump him. You want to try it again?" I wasn't that bad. You know, but, you know, I believe the reason why I'm standing here tonight is because of actually 10, 11, and 12 also, because the daily inventory, and because, you know, I wasn't an overnight sensation like some people are in here. I'm still working on it. Still working on it. I fall short every day. I have to look. I have to examine. I have to pray every night. Heavenly Father, how can I be a better guy? You know, with the little ash. You know, looking for the selfishness and the resentments and the all the other stuff that we can muster up during the daytime. You know, when we're out there, it's real easy to be loving and caring and huggy and lovey in here. You know, but when the rubber meets the road, when you go out there, that's where it counts. And I really try hard out there. I really try hard. Because I want to treat people in here and out there the same way. And that's what it's all about. And I try to do that. Sometimes it's real mushy. You know what I mean? I actually talk to tall people and they, you know, get real friendly. I'm only there for 2 seconds. But that's how I got to be. You know? I have to be nice to everyone. I can't be like, "No, I'm having a... Yeah. Thank you. $5 to go through my toll." Never mind. No opinion. You know, having had a spiritual awakening, and I have, as a result of these steps, you know, and that's the message I try to carry. You know, I try to practice these principles in all my affairs. You know, I ask God on a daily basis, you know, guess what? You know, every morning I still ask Him to help me stay sober today. I don't have it anymore. I don't want it. I need all the help I can get, and I know that. And that's why I keep coming back here, and I keep doing what I'm doing, and I sponsor guys. Because I'll never be able to pay back Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this is something beyond my wildest dream, believe me. And there's nothing I could never thought of this. My buddies look at me today that I grew up with, and they're clueless. They don't know what I'm about or what I'm doing, but all they'll know is I look good. And I'm not that same guy. And you know what they tell me? "Mike, whatever that AA thing you're doing, man, keep it up, man." I'm truly blessed. You know, those two brothers, My first 4 years sober, I lost them. Direct result of alcohol and drugs. And I love those guys. So I hold on to my seat dearly. And I would ask you, please, to hold on to your seat dearly. Because for a guy like me, this is life or death. And thank you.